A Rogue of One's Own by Evie Dunsmore, an extraordinary women novel. Deep in the cool green woods of Wycliffe Park, Tristan Ballantyne, the second son of the Earl of Rochester, had just decided to spend all his future summers at Wycliffe Hall. He might have to befriend Tommy, greatest prig at Eton, to put this into practice. But the morning walks alone would be worth it. Unlike the estate of his family seat, where every shrub was pruned and accounted for, Wycliffe Park left nature to its own devices. The air was sweet with the fragrance of forest flowers, and he had found a most suitable place for reading Wordsworth, a circular clearing at the end of a hollow way. A large standing stone loomed at its center. Dew drenched young Tristan's trouser legs as he circled the monolith. It looked suspiciously like a fairy stone, weathered and conical, planted here before all time, of course, at 12 years of age. Tristan was too old to believe in fairies and the like. His father had made this abundantly clear. He shrugged out of his coat and spread it on the grass, then made to stretch himself out on his belly. The fine fabric of his trousers promptly grated like chain mail against the broken skin on his backside, making him lurch in pain. His father drove his lessons home with a cane, and yesterday the Earl had been overzealous again. It was why Mama had grabbed him, Tristan, and he had grabbed his books, and they had taken off to visit her lady friend, Lady Wycliffe, for the summer. Tristan tried finding a comfortable position, shifting this way and that. Then he gave up, unhooked his braces, and began unbuttoning the fall of his peaky trousers. The next moment, the ground began to shake. For a beat, he froze. He snatched his coat and dove behind the standing stone just as a black horse thundered into the hollow way, a magnificent animal, gleaming with sweat, foam flying from his bit. The kind of stallion kings and heroes rode. It scrambled to a sudden halt on the clearing, sending loops of soil flying with plate-sized hooves. Tristan gasped with shocked surprise. The rider was no king, no hero. The rider was not a man at all. It was a girl. She wore boots and breeches like a boy and rode astride, but there was no doubt she was a girl. A coolly shimmering fall of ice-blonde hair streamed down her back and whirled around her like a silken veil when the horse pivoted. He couldn't have moved had he tried. He was stunned, his gaze riveted to her face. Was she real? Her face was perfect, delicate and heart-shaped with fine winged eyebrows and an obstinate, pointy little chin. A fairy. But her cheeks were flushed and angry pink, and her lips pressed into a line. She looked ready to ride into battle on the big black beast. She made a slide from the saddle, and he shrank back behind the stone. He should show himself. His mouth went dry. What would he say? Her boots hit the ground with a light thud. She muttered a few soft words to the stallion, then nothing. He craned his neck. The girl was gone. Quietly, he crept forward. When he rose to a crouch, he spotted her supine form in the grass, her slender arms flung wide. He might have moved a little closer, closer even. He straightened, peering down. Her eyes were closed. Her lashes lay dark and straight against her pale cheeks. The glimmering strands of her hair fanned out around her head like rays of a white, cold winter sun. Tristan's heart was racing. A powerful ache welled from his core, an anxious urgency, a dread of sorts. This was a rare, precious opportunity, and he was woefully unprepared to grasp it. He had not known girls like this existed, outside the fairy books and the princesses of the Nordic sagas he had been reading in secret. An angry snort tore through the silence. The stallion was approaching, ears flat and teeth bared. Girl's eyes snapped open. They stared at each other, she on her back, him looming. She was on her feet like a shot. You! You're trespassing! She had looked petite, but they stood nearly eye to eye. He felt his face freeze in a dim-witted grin. No, I... Stormy gray eyes narrowed at him. I know who you are. You are Lady Rochester's son. He remembered to bow his head. Quite nicely, too. Tristan Ballantyne. You were spying on me. No, yes, well, a little, he admitted, for he had. It was the worst moment to remember that the flap of his trousers was still half undone. Reflexively, he reached for the buttons, and the girl's gaze followed. She gasped. Next he knew, her hand flew up, and pain exploded in his left cheek. He staggered back, disoriented and clutching his face. He half expected his hand to come away smeared with red. He looked from his palm to her face. Now that was uncalled for. A flicker of uncertainty, perhaps contrition, briefly cooled the blaze in her eyes. Then she rose, raised her hand with renewed determination. You have seen nothing yet, she snarled. Leave me alone, you little ginger. Tristan's cheeks burned, and not from the slap. He knew he had barely grown an inch since his birthday, and yes, he worried the famous Ballantyne height was eluding him. The runt, his brother Marcus called him. His hand curled into a fist. If she were a boy, he'd deck her. But a gentleman never raised his hand to a girl, even if she made him want to. Marcus would have known how to handle this vicious pixie with aplomb. Tristan could only beat a hasty retreat. The slap still pulsing like fire in his cheekbone. The lyrical ballads lay forgotten in damp grass. Well, that's an opening. And if you're looking for a fun read set in Victorian England, featuring characters who could as easily appeal and appear on a sequel to The Crown as the families that hover around the royals, you've found your book. Let me tempt you a bit more by adding more than a dash of women's suffragette passion and unsufferable Oxford male cleverness, and you too may be hooked, ready to pick up this delightful romantic romp and lose yourself in late 19th century Great Britain, Oxford and London in particular, when dukes and duchesses sparred through the opaque traditions that they both regretted and upheld, and when an escape to colonial India could be rightfully considered by a headstrong young duke who was unwilling to bow to the familial demands of his overbearing father, with all of the imperialist falderal that such an option brought with it. Our heroine, whom we just met, the Duchess Lucinda, or Lucy, is, as she tells us herself, not a woman ready to accept the second-class citizenship that Britain, not to mention most of the Western and Eastern world, offered her in her day. No, she's not about to win any Miss Congeniality awards, but she is going to get the publishing empire she is determined will give her and her surreptitious group of like-minded lady investors, for this is a Victorian England, after all, when a group of suffragette women planning for 2 years to raise sufficient funds to purchase a publishing house cannot be done out in the open light of day with such planning. It has to be done in back rooms, in special apartments amongst themselves. But the success of such secret fundraising will give the now grown Lucy and her band of investors the clout to espouse her suffragette expectations, much to their husband's dismay, even if Lucy and company have to wheel and deal with a mousy bureaucrat to get their will expressed. It is a means to an end, not without its financial rewards as well, for Lucy and her friends are crafty enough to realize that the occasional suffragette highlights in the popular and financially successful mainstream magazines she works so hard to own, like Discerning Ladies Magazine and Home Counties Weekly, will only help to expand not only her message, but give her and her investors a more secure income, an income that is not controlled by their husbands, by their friends, by their lovers. And the publishing house she endeavors to head will give her the ability to publish suffragette calls to arms, offering the thriving Victorian book market a bold new way to publicize the cause of women's rights. Of course, what is a good romance without some romantic intrigue? And today's book does not disappoint. After that exciting setup of Lucy and Lord Tristan Ballantyne in the early chapters, which
do give the author the opportunity to waspishly point out that Lady Lucy's not-so-Victorian approach to domestic life and Lord Ballantyne's adult long efforts to charm the fairer sex result in more than one occasion when Lady Lucy and Lord Ballantyne tangle with each other and with others in their objectives, which sometimes intersect, but sometimes are oh so differently approached. For while Lucy has been scheming to obtain a publishing house to espouse her cause, Lord Tristan Ballantyne has grown up into an adult, gone to Oxford, and then off to war in Afghanistan, where he became, of all things, a war hero. Now returned, he indeed himself is taking up the idea of a publishing house. For though Lord Ballantyne is dead set against our protagonist's life passion to advance the cause of women's rights, he's a stuck-up stick-in-the-mud, he does see the cause of women's rights upending his dreams, after all, if they indeed become the focus of a steady and easy income from the publishing empire he just bought into as well. Lucy and Tristan, tweens no more, publishing house owners, let the troubles and the romantic fun explode. Gracing the pages of A Rogue of One's Own is delightfully tongue-in-cheek. Hopefully you heard that. And it is, for without its snappy flavor, this would have been a dreadful conventional read. And who needs that at this time of year? And other critics, other readers, seem to agree. As one wrote, quote, "This is filled to the brim with witty banter, sharp women, self-aware yet powerful men, an historical setting with a refreshingly modern sense of female independence," end quote. Another reviewer, quote, "I adore this series. Historical romance with a slap of women's suffrage? Bring it, babe, and keep them coming. Want more? Our author is a sorcerer when it comes to creating long simmering intensity between her characters. There's not a knife on earth sharp enough to cut through all of Lucy and Tristan's tension during the entirety of this book. And don't even get me started on the banter, because this is absolutely bees who love good dialogue approved. I found it amazing," end quote. And, as I noted, it's part of the author's A League of Extraordinary Women series, so there's more. And since the publisher is no slouch when it comes to giving something back to its readers, in addition, it includes a book club guide to prompt discussions, of which I'm sure any modern romance reader can find plenty to engage for an hour or two or more. Now, sure, there are no great truths of human existence to be encountered here. There's no great character study, and there's no great discovery of human nature. There's some sex. And the novel's story assumes that British imperialism and the march of the rest of the Victorian age travails upon larger humanity are not worth much criticism by the lead characters. But if you, like me, get hooked on these characters and their aspirations in the first couple of chapters, I think you'll enjoy this modern sensibility Victorian novel of the woes and joys of the up-and-coming upper classes in that sceptered Isle of England. It's a tale I think you'll enjoy reading. Oh, and there's a cat, too. It is named Boudicca. Let's finish with this encounter between the indomitable Lucy and the ever-waxing on Lord Ballantyne. As our author writes, "The gate to University Park was locked after 9 o'clock, but there was a well-trodden path to the gap in the fence a few yards to the left, large enough to admit children or slight adults. Lucy breathed easier the moment she had slipped through the iron bars. She had been long resolved to walk alone wherever she went. It was the most practical, and furthermore, the idea of a spinster guarding another spinster struck her as ridiculous. She walked rapidly. The misty rain had turned into a drizzle. Cold rivulets ran from her cheeks down to her collar, and her skin rippled with goosebumps. She'd drink a cup of hot tea at home and go to bed for once. Her work would have to wait. She heard them first. Raucous singing that made her ears prick with caution, she slowed. A group of men, university students, appeared on the footpath ahead. Wet steel glinted as they passed beneath a street lamp. Foils. Her stomach gave a nervous lurch. Members of the fencing club? They frequently practiced in the park. They were also known to cause trouble around town. Their bodies singing ceased, and she knew they had spotted her. Bother. They had not stopped out of politeness. A woman alone in a park near midnight was not a lady, and the awareness crackled in the air between them. Their faces came into focus, leering mouths, eyes keen. Three sheets to the wind, each one of them, and wealthy, judging by their top hats. The entitled ones were the worst. Her hand slid into her skirt pocket. Too late, she noticed the man who had come up from behind. Her body recognized him before she did, from the familiar warm scent of tobacco and spice, and it quelled the rush of alarm.
"There you are," Tristan said lightly. "For someone so short, you are bloody fast."
His hand slid around her waist and pulled her flat against his side. She let him sweep her along, dumbfounded, wrapped in the strength of his arm. The group of men ahead dithered.
"Bloody hell," someone said. "It's Ballantyne."
The athletes had sensed it. They stood together, a little more sober.
"A fine evening's for a stroll, isn't it?" Tristan said, friendly.
"Indeed," drawled the young man, with whom he was now toe-to-toe. "Very fine."
"Lovely and mild," said Tristan. "We should continue on with it," the ringleader remarked. "The strolling." "An excellent idea."
Top hats dipped as nods were exchanged. The athletes staggered onward, in a disorderly heap, slapping each other's backs. Someone laughed. A shudder ran through Lucy. They would have tried to make casual sport of her and moved on, looking like exuberant but respectable gentlemen. No one on the other side of the park who saw them walking down the street would have been any wiser. Tristan's arm around her tightened, and her cheek was pressed against the smooth fabric of his coat. She felt anything but safe. The way Tristan moved, on the cusp of a crouch, called to mind a predator's prowl, and his silence was entirely too preoccupied. Just like there was apparently a blade hidden in his silly cane, there was a mean, well-honed cutting edge to him, concealed by the glibness and his crimson waistcoat. She peered up at his face. He was focused on the path ahead, a faint smile on his lips. A shudder ran down her arms. A Nero would smile like this while turning down his thumb. He was a thousand shades of angry. She strained against his hold, and he released her easily. The night was immediately colder. She'd have welcomed any one of his annoying remarks now, but he remained silent as they walked side by side. He wordlessly stood back as she wriggled through another gap in the park fence and watched as he, somehow, vaulted the fence without becoming stuck on the wrought iron spikes. He followed her like a formidable shadow down Norham Gardens, and she knew better than to try and set him away. She would have to thank him. Our story goes on, of course. Lucy and Tristan have yet more encounters. Romantic sparks fly. Witty banter ensues. A Rogue of One's Own by Evie Dunsmore, an extraordinary women novel. It's a fun read if you're into Victorian novels, if you're into romance. And who isn't from time to time? It's available at all of our fine local libraries, including, of course, the West Lafayette Public Library. Thanks for listening.